Hello, my friends. Welcome to another edition of Profiles of Color. If you're into wines, you're really going to enjoy this conversation. And even if you're not, hearing an Afro-Latina sommelier talk about how she evolved into becoming a wine professional may make you actually want to take a sip. As it always happens, when we look into areas that are not considered the norm for people of color, unfortunately, the wine industry is no different and has a long way to go when it comes to diversity and inclusion. Although there are signs of progress. That said, in this $72 billion industry, approximately one of 1,000 winemakers are Black. As far as I can tell in doing the math, that brings the count to about a handful of African-American winemakers. It may also help to explain why there are only three Black master sommeliers in the world, last count. And to put an exclamation point on all of this, there are just over a handful of Latino-owned vineyards here in the U.S. So in addition to this being an enlightening conversation about wine, the opportunity to talk to a rising Afro-Latina star in the wine industry, who is also the founder of Vino Concierge, couldn't be more timely. So we have with us today, Lydia Richards. Of course, we all know her by Teffy, but Lydia has a really unique thing that she's doing amongst all of the things she's done really since going away to go to school. Lydia, welcome to Profiles of Color.
Thank you so much for having me, Vincent. I'm so excited to be here and speak to you and talk a little bit about my background and where I'm going.
Yeah, well, your background starts out unique because you're from a place that not everybody knows about. A lot of people do. A lot of people associate it with the Panama Canal, but you are from Panama, Central America, and you actually grew up there. And so you have quite a bit of a heritage there. And the interesting thing to me is growing up, and I know a lot about Panama, but growing up in Panama and then leaving to go to school, not here in the United States, but all the way to Europe, had to be quite a change for you.
It was certainly a culture shock, obviously. And I had traveled before going, you know, visited the U.S. and so forth, but Europe was certainly a new experience for me. In terms of the culture, I went to study fashion. I went to this school called Instituto Marangoni, which is an Italian school. A lot of, you know, famous fashion designers.
That was in London,
there.
Correct?
Exactly. So I went to the London campus because.
Why Europe, though?
I think because I was so enthralled with fashion and, you know, all of my favorite designers were European based. And to be honest, I mean, I knew the United States, but I definitely wanted a new experience and it just felt right. And this school actually came to my school in Panama and spoke about all the opportunities that there were. And I was so interested in fashion. So they actually helped, this company helped me with the paperwork and everything to get there. So I was certainly I just wanted something new and something different and something exciting. And I definitely got it.
So you were in high school when you found out about this school.
Exactly. Yeah. One of my favorite designers at the time, Dolce & Gabbana, one of the designers actually went to the school that I went to. So I thought that was so cool. And, you know, I wanted to learn everything I could from fashion because I'm still very passionate about it.
Yeah, so not to get ahead of myself, but one of the great things about your story is that you are representative of a lot of young people that in high school, some think they know what they want to do and they go after it, you know, full speed ahead. And then things happen and they actually may end up in another career. So it sounds like to me when you were in high school, it was all things fashion. You were totally into the whole fashion industry. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I think it was also very much because I was, you know, going crazy for Vogue, all these magazines. And, you know, a lot of the American influence that we have in Panama was about, you know, living in Paris and or living in London and having this kind of European experience that truly got me thinking. I definitely wanted to do fashion, but I also wanted that experience of living in a different country, experiencing different cultures. Now that I look back on it, you know, I think that was sort of my gateway to get that experience.
To get that. So it wasn't just the fashion. It was the opportunity to get out of Dodge.
Exactly. And I didn't realize it then, but now it's looking back. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, hindsight, all of us do that, right? But I will say this. So one of the things I know about the Richards family is that you guys, your family has a very creative mindset. Everybody is very creative and has that designer's mind and that type of thing going actually a few generations back in your family. Do you think that that had some influence on you when you were in high school or middle school and trying to figure out what you were interested in and things like that?
I think so. I think, and that's something that I would give credit to my family. First and foremost, my cousins who were also living in the United States, and I would remember thinking about their experience and how I wanted my life to go. And even my own parents, you know, they're both doctors, but they were never the people that would be like, oh, you can only be a doctor or an engineer. They kind of allowed us, me and my sister, to dream bigger than that or dream a little bit crazier than that.
They gave you the freedom to just go after whatever you were interested in.
Exactly. And that kind of goes ahead. In even when I went into, they were kind of okay with fashion. And then I was like, wait, alcoholic beverages. That's sort of what I want to do.
So what was it like when you first arrived in Europe, in London, and started getting acclimated to living in Europe?
So I went to London and I lived there, and that was, it was a huge impact because I'm coming in from sunny Panama. It's always one beautiful, sunny, warm weather, hot weather, correct. And then going into London,
hot.
I didn't like humidity, hot, exactly. The beach, going into London.
From that to fog?
Yeah, to no sun. I remember because I got there around September, and there were days like, you know, you would wake up, there was no sun, and the sun would go down at like 1 or 2 p.m. because that was something that truly affected me. But I think overall, because I was kind of young and fresh and like getting all these new experiences, it might have not bothered me that much. Also, I was in a school where there was probably four people of color aside from me.
Wow.
It was mostly Europeans, Russians, some Americans, but yeah, there was and Latinos. In sense,
in terms of how you immersed in the school, how you did in school, in terms of you being one of a few, or was it not
I don't know. I don't think it affected me. I was always that person that I've always been very sure of my goals. So I, you know, was studying hard, but I was also, don't tell my parents, but I was partying hard too. So I was definitely part of the experience.
But okay.
I mean, now they know, but I mean, I turned out okay.
They probably knew at the time. Trust me, as a parent of three daughters, we know.
Exactly. So, but you know, I was always very responsible and I did my job and my work and everything I needed to do. And I also kind of was in with a group of really cool people from all over the world. One of my really close friends was from Russia, Sweden, and one guy from Mexico. So I think we created this like community of all of us coming from
different places.
And we kind of became a family. And to this day, we're still pretty close. And that and me coming in at 18, but they were a little bit older than me, like 22, 23. They really took me under the wing. So I really appreciate them. But in general, looking back at the classes, and I had one teacher that would always use me as an example of like, you know, in terms of finance and statistics, Lydia is, you know, she's mixed race or she's Black. She's from Panama. She is a left-handed person. So I was always used as an example of somebody that, wow, it's like not common that you're there.
Well,
so I remember that. You know,
not all the time.
Yeah, not all the time, but sometimes I was just like, please stop. But, you know, I understand what he was trying to do in terms of example.
Where was he from? Do you know? Do you remember?
Oh, as UK as you can get. I don't think I've ever met any more Brit than that teacher.
1,000% British?
100%. I think he was just so excited to have somebody so diverse. Said he would always use me, for example.
So he wasn't malicious about it. It was more of his fascination with it.
Absolutely. It wasn't malicious at all. But yeah, it's just funny.
Yeah. So you studied fashion. How did you like your studying there? I mean, is that something that you always carry with you, even though you didn't end up making it per se a career?
No, absolutely. And you know, the overall experience was just phenomenal. I was able to intern for really amazing designers and kind of like get the lay of the land. I was still within the marketing and PR aspect of things. And that was something that actually helped me transition into the wine industry, because that's sort of what I do here now. So I've used all of that knowledge, and I've just been able to kind of, you know, kind of transfer it over in terms of skills to what I'm doing now. So yeah. And even like my own personal like styling, I'm very, very specific about the things that I wear, what I do, because it is also important for me. Image is important for me.
Yeah. So you ended up in Paris after school before you came back from Europe, went back to Panama from Europe. While you were in school and before or when you went to Paris, did you also travel to other countries in Europe?
Yes. So I was able to go with my cousin, my aunts, but even, you know, we would do like not expensive weekend trips, because you could get super cheap, like EasyJet type of type of like flights for like 30 euros to go to Stockholm. So we would, and we had a friend that lived there. So I was able to kind of like experience.
So you did it all diversity. On the cheap. It was with relatives and friends and.
Oh, yeah. As a proper student.
Did you take the train anywhere?
Yes. So I took the Eurostar and I took it to Paris quite often. And then also I'm trying to think Rail Italia. I think I also used it to go to Italy. That was a little bit longer, but no, right. It was just phenomenal, phenomenal experience. I look back and, you know, I want to do it all over again.
So besides the travel you did in terms of Paris, what was the attraction to Paris for you? I was going to say besides the fashion aspect, which is obvious to everybody, but what attracted you to Paris enough to go spend some time there?
I think I've always, for as long as I could remember, just the idea of being in Paris, the Eiffel Tower, learning about the history from even like Napoleon, Marie Antoinette, it was something that always caught my attention. It just felt like a place that I needed to visit. It wasn't even like I needed to go there. I think and I've always been very interested in movies and kind of film and like TV and you know, it's sort of that hype thing that you have with Paris. It's like, this is the most amazing place with the most amazing history and culture. I mean, and they're not wrong. I mean, French people, I love them to death, but they are the craziest people too. But you know, I always felt connected. And I had a really good friend that was French. She was actually from the South. And she moved to Paris. We used to live together, and then she moved to Paris, and I decided to go because I wanted to learn French, which I'm still not great at, but you know, I was really able, she also took me under her wing, and I was able to hang out with her friends and experience like the real Paris, not the one that the tourist one.
Immerse yourself in the culture.
And that's sort of when wine started for me, because that is such a huge part of the French culture.
It's the biggest part.
Yeah. Yeah. Wine, food, and everything is just so well taken care of. People take care of the land. I was actually, when I was living there, she had friends that had really small vineyards. It wasn't anything commercial for commercial production. It was mostly like friend of a friend's grandparents had a vineyard. So we would go and kind of pick the grapes and see how that went about. But like in a very casual way, I knew nothing of wine, but how it was so ingrained into their everything. It was just right. Their life, their food, and how the food pairings worked, and you do this and you do that, and how vintages are. I mean, it was this whole thing that I just remember being like, I need to learn more about it.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things in all cultures, but particularly in the French culture as an example, is it's about respecting their culture. And if you are willing to do that and show respect to the culture and get involved in their way of doing things, you'll do a lot. You'll have a lot more fun than if you do the, as I call sometimes, the American thing, where you just, you know, come in and stick your nose up in the air and it's like, no, we don't work like that. You can go to another country or whatever. So that's cool that you enjoyed it. Yeah. So how long were you in Paris?
I was just there for like almost 6 months.
It was just a quick.
Yeah.
But you had a good time.
Oh yeah. I had the best time. Like I said, my French is not that great, but I think I definitely got a lot of other things from that experience and just made me overall a more independent person. I think my whole European experience, I think, is the best thing that I've ever done, because if I would have stayed in Panama, I think I would have might have been a different career path, but you know, I'm very happy that I did that.
You saw things that you would not have seen just staying in Panama, or that goes for anybody staying in the United States. Yeah. If you don't go abroad and see some of the other things that people are experiencing, et cetera. So I can mm-hmm. see that. I was curious too about while you were still just fresh finishing up your fashion education, did you go to like Milan, Italy or anything like that? You know, cause that's also another fashion capital, if you will.
Yeah, no, actually because with my school, you could transfer over. They had three campuses, actually, London, Paris and Milan, sort of the bigger fashion cities. So I went there for like a class for like a week. And then I had a friend that did the transfer second year. So I went to Milan and I really, really loved it. I think London and Paris were still closer to my heart in terms of that. So because I even considered doing that, but like learning Italian while being in college, it just made sense to stay in London. But I absolutely loved it. They're all very different, but you know, they're also all very passionate, you know, within right. their own culture. So it was very inspiring.
So from Paris, you went back to Panama.
Yes.
And when you went back, with the intention of doing what? What was the plan?
So actually, the reason why I went back, because my dad had a surgery. So, you know, we were kind of taking care of him for a little while. But
it's been that long since he had that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It all happened sort of around that time. That's why I made the decision to come back. And I wasn't necessarily sure exactly what I wanted. I thought about moving to the U.S. And I figured, you know, I had some time in Panama to figure things out and, you know, spend time with my family. But I was there not even like a month. And my dad was like, you know that you don't belong here. go and do whatever it is that you need to do. So then I decided to, yeah, I was thinking about places where I could go. I actually spent some time in Texas after I moved out of Panama. But
You went to Texas first. That was the first place you went to in the States.
Yeah, it made sense because Neiman Marcus headquarters is based there, and that's one of the bigger companies in terms of like high end fashion. And I was still very much into that frame of work that I wanted to work in fashion. But man, that was another culture shock from Paris to Panama to Texas. Then Texas. Oh yeah. Boy,
Texas is a country by itself.
Yeah. And that was my first experience living in the U.S. And I was like, you know, nothing. I think Texas is fantastic, but definitely I knew that I had to go to New York. I think New York was definitely the place for me.
So when you went to Texas and you were looking at places like Neiman Marcus, were you interested in on the buyer side of fashion? Was that what you were looking at that?
That was sort of my goal after kind of, you know, being in college and doing a few internships here and there, like being in the sales side, buying team and styling. I realized like buying was definitely the one that I kind of wanted to focus on. It didn't end up happening that way, but yeah, that was my main place. So that's the main area that I wanted to focus on when I was first starting out.
Yeah, I'm drawing a mental map now. I got you. You go from Panama to London, you zigzag all over Europe a little bit, stop over in Paris, come back to Panama, flip over to Texas. And now are you headed to New York?
That's fine. It was only about 2 months in Texas and then New York City, Big Apple. And I've been here, 10 years?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you like New York.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of this, at this point I'm here because they always say like, you know, 10 years is you're a true New Yorker after 10 years. It's been like a whole relationship that passes ups, downs, not for everybody, but I think I made the cut for sure. I feel like a New Yorker now for sure.
So I spent all this time talking about how you got started. Let's talk about your arrival in New York and how you went from public relations and marketing, et cetera. Just tell us about all of that and where the sommelier started coming into the picture.
For sure. I came here and I actually, my first job, I actually worked a couple of jobs in fashion. I worked first as an intern for a fashion designer called Altuzara. And then I kind of decided that while I was working there, because I was working on the marketing PR side, but I had an opportunity to work for InStyle magazine So I decided to make the jump to magazines and kind of publications. And that was a whole monster within itself. And that was a fantastic experience. And then I also moved on to Harper's Bazaar. So while all of this is happening, I'm working on, you know, all these like crazy jobs because there's a lot of ups and downs.
And New York is expensive to live in.
And New York is expensive to live in, and fashion doesn't necessarily pay that much. So it was a little bit of a crazy time. And I always thank my parents because they definitely had my back for a little while before I figure out exactly what I wanted to do. But it was hard for sure. But in
reality check, huh?
Oh, 100%. It's sort of like, wow, okay, I'm in my early 20s. I'm thinking I'm going to do all these things. I'm going to be an amazing top buyer at this whatever fashion firm, and that is not happening. But I just realized while I was doing it that I didn't love it. I didn't like it. I didn't like what I was doing. It just didn't feel right. So then that sort of, and I remember having my friends coming over to visit from Europe, and they were kind of doing their fashion jobs. But my friend, the French one, she actually, I remember her bringing really nice bottles of wine, and then we would still talk about it. And in thinking about that, she actually was one of the first people that say, like, why don't you take like, you know, food and wine classes and, you know, kind of go into that route, just like after work, maybe you'll meet people. Because I, at that point, I didn't know, when I first moved to New York, I didn't know anybody. I kind of did the jump and I was like, okay, I'm going to figure it out while I'm here. So it's like, you know, you'll have a little bit of that social experience. A few years went on by and I just finally pulled the trigger and I was like, okay, I'll take some after work, you know, wine pairing classes. Cause just that's always fun. No, yeah. Just for fun.
No game plan, no business plan, just
for fun. But then I think, yeah, it was like around year five of being in New York. I saw this like ad for this sommelier certification and I was like, okay, so I've been doing all these, you know, really small food and wine pairing classes, like talking to people that worked in restaurants. Maybe I should try, give it a try. And that's sort of when I told my parents about it. It's like, I kind of want to do this. And they're like, why? Like, it just doesn't make any sense. But I was like, you know, just something on the side. And then I met a lot more people in the industry and I kind of got really more into the trade side of being a sommelier and what does it entail and learning. Like, it's crazy the amount of education and, you know, knowledge that you need to have in order to do this. And I passed and I loved it. And I think that moment was when I decided 100% I want to make the jump. So that was another, and I remember my dad saying, oh, you want to be a professional drunk? Ha 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 ha! And he just said it and I was like, Dad, that's not like that. But I remember, that's
priceless.
Now he's changed his mind.
Your parents were very patient, it sounds like.
Yes, they were.
Because they were patient while you were trying to figure out who you were and what you were going to do, and in terms of a long term career, because I think everybody comes out of school, or many come out of school and bounce around a bit trying to figure out what really works. And also the way you did, you majored in one thing, but then you pursued something else and then something else. And you finally found your passion. I didn't want to interrupt you earlier because I'm really good at interrupting people, but you brought up something that I thought was really key. And that is, you found something that you loved. And that you could really sink your teeth into, and probably doesn't feel like, not putting words in your mouth, but probably doesn't feel like work. And it's just something that you enjoy. But at the same time, you're also kind of filling a void, which somebody would say, oh, well, there's a lot of sommeliers out there. Did that cross your mind when you thought, okay, I'm really going to pursue this in terms of a niche or how you wanted to go about it?
Yeah, I know. I certainly thought about that. And I think, and also the way that the my idea of what a sommelier was and how he looked like, because it was mostly a he, definitely was something that I was super afraid at the beginning, thinking that, you know, it's another area in which I'm not going to succeed. Because it was almost like this feeling that I had with fashion. And now I know it was sort of part of my journey. But back then I was like, oh, shoot, I'm failing. You know, I thought that this is what I was going to do. This is what I had my mindset on. And now I'm just doing this 360 change, you know. So I just remember thinking about that. But, you know, I had a great support system and people that
I was going to ask you, Lydia, how did you handle that? How did you handle feeling like, you know, I've done all this stuff. I've been a lot of places. I've worked really hard. I've got this education and it's just not panning out.
No, I mean, it was sort of around, my mid, almost late 20s. And I was feeling like, wow, I'm basically a failure. But like, I think one of the reasons why I've always had pretty much a good drive. Like, no matter how I'm feeling, I'm able to push through for the most part. Yeah, like everybody, I think I do a better job of handling my mental health. And I think that's so important. But I think, you know, as you're in your mid-20s and everything is going on and I'm living in this place and I'm basically by myself, it wasn't easy. But I think my lifeline for sure was my family, my friends. They always had my back. My mom and my dad were always very supportive of pretty much anything that I decided to do. And they just like said, keep going ahead. And one of the things that was key for that my dad told me is like, you know, you have all this knowledge of whatever, because I don't think he knew exactly what I did in fashion either, but he
half
said
the
like,
time
what
we don't know, but go ahead.
Exactly.
I'm just speaking like, as a parent.
Words of support kind of. He's like, why don't, you know, you have all this kind of knowledge. Why don't you just like try to figure out what you can do within this industry that kind of fits that mold. And that was sort of like, even I hadn't even thought about that because in my head, I thought I was just going to do this crazy jump. But, you know, there is marketing, there is PR in the wine industry. And I slowly started learning that as I was meeting more and more people that were working in the industry. And then, you know, while I was doing the transition, I actually got a job in a online wine retailer and like wine storage facility in the Bronx out of all places. And they handled a lot of the Christie's auction house wines. And that was another great learning experience because that's where I learned about vintages and how important they are and all that. And while I was doing also while I was finishing my wine certification, and then I went into another program. So I was like transitioning slowly into the industry and within like a marketing sales role, but like very, very entry level. And that was key because also I was talking to so many people that were already in the industry. I was lucky enough to get amazing mentors that I still talk to. There's this organization called the Dame d'Escoffier, and they help. It's basically women that help other women transition into the industry. And I found out about them through my wine certification courses. And I applied, and I actually got a scholarship, which allowed me to continue my education. And I, you know, we had to write an essay. I'm sure that was sort of like the early years of diversity. I put in, I was an Afro-Latina in Panama and I'm interested in, you know, getting into this industry and learning more about wine and whatever. And, you know, Aileen Robbins, which was the one that gave me the scholarship. She actually passed away 2 years ago, but, you know, she's the one that believed in me and kind of gave me my first kind of big jump into the industry.
Yeah. What did the scholarship entail? What did you end up studying and what did you get from that after you got the scholarship?
So it was tied to a school called the International Wine School. So it was essentially monetary. Yeah. So I was able to use that towards my advance.
Okay. You did mention that earlier. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was so focused on, because you touched on diversity for a minute. And the first question I was going to ask you is, and this term is relatively new to me. You said Afro-Latina.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting. We've heard Hispanic, we've heard Latina, Latino. Is that a term that I'm just not familiar with? Is that something that you kind of made to describe yourself?
You know, that's actually a term that has been gaining more and more momentum as we're kind of exploring that Latin America diaspora. I think people are trying to understand their heritage a little bit better because, I mean, growing up in Panama, and this is just a little bit, we're going back again.
No, that's okay.
I always consider myself Latino. You know, it's like, it's almost like in a weird way, we didn't even see color. We didn't, at least in my family, we didn't really speak about it. And we were just all Latinos. You know, obviously we had Black in us and, you know, my grandparents and, you know, we're kind of a little bit mixed, but, you know, we're mostly from, you know, from the African diaspora, the Caribbean diaspora. But the fact is I started thinking about these terms and start thinking about my own identity being here in the United States. Because people would always ask me, so like, you're not really Black. Like, this is like Black people telling me. So you have a weird, like, I don't know, and your hair, I don't know. Like, you're not really Black. And I would just think, it's like, so what am I? You know, I'm
right.
Like.
Right. And why are you asking anyhow? But okay.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's a whole other conversation. Which I'm much better equipped at handling after right. 10 years in New York. But yeah, no, definitely kind of that. I had that self-discovery in terms of what I am, how I look like. And, you know, I think I like embracing the fact that, you know, we have descendants that come from Africa. I mean, I might not know exactly when and where, which I want to do one of those 23andMe things, because I'm very curious. And my family doesn't really like speak about their, you know, our ancestors. So it's something that I absolutely would love to know. But yeah, no, I guarantee
yours would be very complicated. As most of us. But no, the reason I'm not being facetious, in Panama, I think one of the things I like about Panama is the diversity of Panama, is that you have had people come from all over the world to Panama. And you know, as you know, growing up there, et cetera, that, I mean, I've met people that are Asian that speak fluent Mandarin, but they speak Spanish with a Panamanian accent.
I love that.
And you're like, what? but I think it's great. I think it's a great thing. And I think it is a little bit of a culture shock. Unfortunately, right here in the United States, we deal with people wanting to label you. It's like they feel like they have to, you know, I was talking earlier with Christine, our coordinating producer, about what the experiences are sometimes in terms of, for example, myself, just, you know, Black was used for a long time, then African American, and then you kind of go back and forth between it, and it's really a label, you know. Yeah. And so, but you live in the culture where you kind of have to address it, because you can't, if you dismiss it, that starts a whole nother conversation. But that's enough about that. I think you bring up a really great point. At the same time, coming back to being a sommelier and being in the wine industry, you brought up something else, and that is that it's mostly a male-dominated industry. Now, as you've immersed yourself in it, have you seen that change? Is it starting to open up, or is that still got a ways to go?
I mean, definitely still ways to go, but absolutely, there has been a monumental change, I'd say. Because after I was working at this retailer, my biggest jump was moving into a company called Colangelo and Partners, which is a big events and PR, but dedicated to the wine industry. It's an agency, right? So they do the biggest wine events around the country. They have the biggest clients. So it was sort of like, that's where I truly feel like I found exactly what I wanted to do, that wine marketing, wine PR, doing events type of thing. So while I was immersing myself in these communities, yes, you know, most of the events that I would go to, this is like 500 people events. Sometimes you could count with both your hands the amount of Black people or you know, anybody but white, you know, kind of, or as we call it, BIPOC now.
I'm sorry, what was that?
BIPOC, like BIPOC, BIPOC, sorry, Black Indigenous People of Color. That's like a new term, I guess, that's coming about.
All right. I just showed my age. Go ahead.
But anyway, so yes, diversity was almost nowhere to be seen. I remember even being managing these events and being part of the managing team and people just not believing that I was part of that team. Oh, they would want to speak with a manager, which meant somebody that maybe wasn't young or maybe wasn't a woman or maybe wasn't, you know, person of color. So
yeah,
this was just, we're talking about 2017 here. So I think one of the big, exactly. So moving kind of, I think the biggest shift has been last year, you know, even it's not 2019, 2020 truly with everything that happened with all the Black Lives Matter protests and everything, you truly saw the change and people being more outspoken about their experiences in the wine industry and how, you know, it affected them, or not being able to be invited to events or invited to scholarship opportunities or invited to even like apply to jobs. It is not the type of industry that is open-minded in that sense. And I think the wine industry last year went through a huge reckoning.
You have done some things specific to address that in terms of reaching out to that market, taking advantage of the fact that you're fluent in Spanish and pretend fluent in French. No, I'm kidding with you. So tell us a little bit about your thinking about that, you know, how you decided to, you've decided to expand this universe in terms of the sommelier world.
No, absolutely. And I think sort of it's something that we've always been thinking about, because I partnered with another colleague. She's from Ecuador. Her name is Maria. And I remember us speaking about these things, saying like, oh, you know, there's no Latino, there's no Black people in these events. It's crazy because, you know, we see some stories and there are people that could be in our events, but just are not invited. Right.
Right.
So it's something that we've kind of been talking about, but 2020 happened. And like I was saying, Black Lives Matter protests are happening. There's a huge reckoning. Something else that happened in the wine industry was this huge story that came out last year about the Court of Master Sommelier, which is, I would say, the largest sommelier association in the world, and how the Americas chapter of it was, there was a few of the master sommeliers that were being very inappropriate with a lot of the women. And I think it was a complaint of about 25 or so women in the industry that, you know, there was some unwanted sexual advancements and so forth. So this is all happening in the industry, not just the diversity, but, you know, the problem in terms of men not respecting women.
Wow.
And it's just like snowballing into this huge thing. So an association called Black Wine Professionals started around, I wouldn't say September, no, actually August. Around August. Yes, August last year.
Okay, and so recently, and in the middle of the pandemic.
And in the middle of the protest, all of this is happening. And I remember feeling so inspired by it, because it truly felt like, you know, they're building this community to help other Black people that are trying to get into the industry with, and they started doing, you know, educational resources, helping them with like professional opportunities, and just overall highlighting that there are Black wine professionals, because for some reason, in most of the spaces that we were going in or the stories that were published, they were nowhere to be seen. So
where are they based out of?
I believe, it's formed by this woman called Julia Coney. She's a force. Actually, they are in Maryland. We can figure this out.
No, I'm just curious. Yeah.
She's phenomenal.
That's made a difference already in this short period of time.
Absolutely. And I think the overall, the cry of the industry, it was just like that tipping point. People wanted to be wanted to see more diverse faces. I think everything just started gaining more momentum. And then I spoke to my colleague called Maria, and then we decided, like, you know, it's also true in terms of Hispanics, because I mean, I'm Black, but I'm also Latina, and I see the lack of representation of our spaces. You know, we're most, I think it's about 30% of all workers that work in the wine industry are Latino. They're working in the vineyards, but they don't have health insurance. They you know, it's something that you just don't see.
Oh, so you're talking about a whole nother side of it that no one pays attention to.
Nobody cares about. And obviously this is all happening during the pandemic. Mostly they're undocumented workers, and they're just not being protected. And, you know, people still want wine. Actually, people wanted wine even more than a regular year. I think sales for wine went about like 300% just last year.
Last year, everybody was at home drinking.
Exactly. Like that I think one of the
in between Zoom calls.
100%. Or actually during, I guess.
During.
Yeah.
I'm on mute for a second. I need to, I'll be right back.
No, it's crazy to think that, but yeah, wine sales in general just came about, but you know,
100% or more, huh?
Even more, yeah. So, you know, you look at the reports because we're still kind of gathering information. Now I work for an importer, so I get access to a lot of like those overall trend reports. Mm-hmm. And last year, I don't think it's going to be, it's unmatched to any other year in terms of wine and alcoholic beverage consumption.
So, well, and then that's the demand thing. So if it goes up in terms of sales, which is great, but then it puts pressure on the distributors, which then puts pressure on the makers, right?
Absolutely. And then it, all the way back to the people working, vineyard stewards, the people working in the vineyard. So, you know, looking at that, we're like, you know, we want to spotlight, and we, obviously it's something that we're still working on, but we want to make sure that, you know, people know that there are Latinos working in the industry, that, you know, we're in very different fields. And then, you know, we should also support the people that are working in the vineyards because they are doing the work that basically nobody wants to do, which is something that you can say about the Latino immigrant in the U.S. in general. So, and it's such a vital and important part of the wine industry. We built this organization called Hispanics and Wine, and we're gaining momentum, and you're making sure that we're not only highlighting the amazing Latinos and Hispanic people that work within these spaces, but just making sure that the wine industry is catering to the Latino and Hispanic consumer. That's, I think I was reading an article recently that's saying like we're a growing market, but just no wine company is like necessarily reaching out to them. Like, you know, we have the language capabilities and all that. So We want to make sure that we're making the community and ourselves known a little bit better. And I think that's important because that's going to lead to other opportunities in terms of jobs. And we got to take advantage of all the diversity happening right now.
Yeah. So let's delve into your expertise a bit, because you move into another area that I wanted to talk with you about anyhow. And that is how wine is used in different cultures. And how much of that is a factor as a sommelier to know, like if you're dealing with the Latin culture or the European culture or the general white American culture or the Black culture, et cetera, et cetera. You know, how do you look at that? How do you address that?
Right. I think because we've always been at least the wine industry, the way that they train you, it's very much focused to it's Eurocentric. So it's like, you know, how to pair French wines. We usually do it with French food because there is a regionality that comes with it, right?
Right.
You know, for the most part, a wine that's coming from a specific region, the food that's coming from that specific region will be the best pairing for it. So that's sort of the mindset of things. But as I was navigating all these spaces and people were asking me questions about wine, I kind of had to be a little bit more creative, you know, and it's something that I still use. For example, if I'm speaking with, and I've been doing a lot of these actually virtual tastings with Crush Global, which is a travel agency where we cater mostly to Black Americans. So I try to make it more, I would say, how do I say this? Make it more relatable, because wine can be this like ethereal thing and like this thing that just nobody can get. So no, wine is this amazing beverage that should be drunk and enjoyed by everybody. So the other day, there was this guy from the South.
So all Black people aren't winos. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
I mean, I think they should be, but like, I understand why.
Go ahead.
But no, but it's something that I was just like, everybody should be able to be a wino. I want to make everybody a wino for sure. And, you know, this guy from the South was saying like, oh, but I don't know how collard greens or cornbread would pair well with whatever. And I was like, you know what? No, because it is fatty and it is delicious. And there's the butter component. I definitely think something like a Chardonnay from Napa, which has similar flavor profiles, could work as a wonderful pairing. He's like, oh, nobody's actually said that. Or even when I'm speaking with Latinos or people from Panama, we're talking about carimañolas or like torrejas or tortillas. And I was like, you know what? Sparkling wine goes amazing with all of these things that we enjoy, because it's kind of going back to that flavorful, fatty dish that goes really well with like the high acid in the sparkling wines. And it just like refreshes your palate as you're eating. So like explaining all of these things.
That is really cool.
Yeah. And I think
there may be a wine that goes with chicken and waffles.
There's absolutely a wine that goes with, it's actually sparkling wine. So it's sort of that same idea, like the sweet and the fatty and the buttery component goes excellent with something that has with a type of wine that has high acid. But anyway, so absolutely.
No, but your point is well taken, because what you're saying is, because whether you're having, you know, an Italian dish, a French dish, a steak, or whatever you're eating, there are wines to go with that. So full confession, not a wine connoisseur, so I don't proclaim to be, but I will tell you, I had a great joy and experience of going to a wine tasting at Napa Valley. It was a huge type of a deal because it was a 12-course meal, and there were, I think we probably were served like 8 different wines. It's been a number of years, but it gave me that first look into what you're talking about, which is how different wines apply to different types of food. But I think what's even more key with what you're saying in this conversation is the people that don't realize that a wine can go with a course of a meal that they never would have thought of.
Right.
You know, so if somebody, you know, is having, I don't know, barbecue ribs with all the trimmings, you're saying there's a wine that will go with that.
I can give you 5 wines that can go with it right now. Like,
there
you can go Garnacha, we can go Malbec. I mean, there are so many things, because if you know the wine characteristics, and that's something I know, I can help you with whatever it is that you're cooking. So there is a wine for pretty much every type of dish. It's just because it hasn't been explored, but people more, you're seeing it more and more. You've seen people like experimenting a little bit more with wine instead of keeping it as this snobby thing that only a certain amount of people know. And it shouldn't be the case, because wine is done, and that's something I always say, wine is done in every single continent in this world. And how is it possible that we're just like narrowing the consumer to like a very small pool? No, sure. Everybody should be able to enjoy it and have fun with it and play with it a little bit.
So you created a company called Vino Concierge. And what was the philosophy behind creating that? And what all do you do and plan on doing with this entity of yours?
Well, full confession, I started that in 2017 as I myself was still trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I was fresh out of all my certifications. I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be an entrepreneur. Obviously, you know, I had the company, but it started gaining momentum a few years later. But in terms of that, I do mostly like virtual wine tastings. I do corporate tastings now as well. So essentially, like companies, they want to do like a happy hour or some kind of like team building experience, they would hire me. And it's worked really well for the virtual world, because I've been able to like connect with people in Canada and Spain and California.
Without having to travel.
This is the sad part, but it's still, you know, it's convenient sometimes in terms of logistics.
Sure.
And also I've been, and another thing that I wanted to do is sort of going back to our previous conversation about being able to communicate this in Spanish, you know, reaching that Hispanic consumer that tends to be quite forgotten a little bit about, and then talking about like these type of fun food pairings that people just might not think that are happening. So I do like small consumer events, but I also do corporate events. And that's sort of why, how I want to keep going about it, because I think that people are not going to get bored of these things, whether it's in person or virtual. I think there's still a wonderful, wonderful space for it.
Have you taken some of this expertise back to Panama?
Yes, actually. And I think I would definitely say thank you to my sister, because my sister, she's this phenomenal PR person in Panama. She's very well connected. I've been able to, you know, speak in cooking shows. I've been able to kind of do like small virtual seminars, connect with people in the culinary world in Panama, and actually discover a wine community in Panama that I didn't even know it existed.
So wow, really?
Yeah. And they are very serious, and they know their stuff very well. So it's
That's
been very,
neat.
Very.
And you're connected with them now?
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm sure I still have long ways to go, but they are there and they have been really nice and embraced me, and I'm having conversations with them all the time. And hopefully when we're able to travel in a more safely manner, I'm going to be able to connect with them in person. So yeah. And lately I've been doing sort of these like columns, I mean, seasonal columns, like best wines for Thanksgiving, or I'm sorry, no, for Panamanian Christmas, best wines for Valentine's Day, and do those fun pairings that we were talking about. Like, oh, this goes great with tamal. You know, this wine goes great with carimañolas. This wine goes great with arroz con pollo. You know, all of our, and kind of like immersing wine into our culture and into our food, which I think is so important.
So when you go, I'm going to have a little fun with you. When you go back home to Panama to visit, does mom and dad send you down to the liquor store and say, hey, we're going to have this for dinner. Bring us some appropriate wine.
I mean, I'm sure they have used me in the past, but I think at this point, my dad would calls me, either does a WhatsApp or a video call, be like, hey, your mom wants some wine. What should I get? And he just like takes a video of it and I tell him what to get. So they've been using and they're going to be able to use it for the rest of their lives. So they're free virtual sommelier for now.
So let's take advantage of the time we have remaining and talk a little bit about your advice to the up and coming, because you've been through it. You know, we just talked about all the way from in high school when you discovered things regarding fashion and your whole trek to Europe and school, and then kind of, for lack of a better term, stumbling into the wine and food thing, and now really serious with the sommelier. But you've zigzagged your way there, so to speak. And as you mentioned earlier, you had challenges with it, and at times you were even questioning yourself and things like that. So somebody that's in high school or even in college that may have some interest in related, you know, wine or the culinary or both or that type of thing, what's your advice to them?
Okay. I would say overall, Well, looking back and like, don't be afraid. If you find out about this amazing community. I mean, I think now it's a little bit different. We have Instagram, we have social media that allows you to connect with people directly. I think that's a game changer. I remember, I mean, we had it when I was younger, but not in the level that we have now. I think if you see somebody's career or something that interests you, try to DM them. The worst thing is that they don't respond, but you know, there are ways to communicate and try to get mentors and do that networking thing. I think that was one of the things that truly changed things for me, like taking advantage of that and just not being afraid. The worst thing that somebody can say no, right? So I think that's something really important. And I think you develop confidence as you go along, but to be honest, I get kids from like 18, 19, 20, 21 year olds that tell me like, oh, they love what I'm doing and they want to connect and they want to have a conversation and get my advice. So I've been getting a lot of that proactiveness. So I think that's something that is so important. And if they want a career in wine, I definitely suggest getting that education. I think wine is something that kind of heavily relies on you having this like sort of that database of different things. So I think whether it is the Wine and Spirits Education Trust, which is one of the education arms of wine, or a sommelier certification, it's something that will benefit you 100%. So definitely those two things. And also don't be afraid if you decide you go into an industry or wine and you decide you don't love it, don't be too hard on yourself and try to figure out your next move. Whatever existing skills that you have, just, you know, they can be applicable to multiple industries. So it's not completely lost. So I think that was something that I was always very hard on myself. And now I'm not anymore because I'm doing much better. But it was, I remember that feeling of failing. And, you know, just now looking back, I was like, I was so young, you know, and I'm sure that's, and I'm sure that's something that's going to continue happening as I keep going, you know, forth and forth. That's, now I realize what, you know, my parents and when my older friends were saying, it's like, you got time, don't worry.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you guys are always in a hurry, but but so with your level of experience and expertise, do you have a mentor?
I do. I still do. Actually, I actually have several.
Okay.
I work right now, aside from my what I'm doing with Hispanics in wine and then Vino Concierge, I work for a wine importer. Bethany, my supervisor, has been a phenomenal guide in through this whole process, connecting with key people. And even beyond that, I work with somebody named Yvonne, who is a Master of Wine student. There's only like 500 Masters of Wines in the world. And her knowledge has been incredible. So I try to get as many mentors as I can. So I see somebody who's doing very cool things, I try to reach out to them. Obviously, some people answer, some people don't, but I think it's something that greatly has benefited my career. And I don't expect to stop anytime soon.
Yeah. How do you, if somebody's in college and they're studying whatever they're studying, culinary, or maybe they're studying the hospitality industry, and they're interested in the wine industry, how do you network when you're, you know, at a relatively young age? Let's just say they're 21 and over.
Okay, good. Yeah, so they're 21 and over. So we work with a lot of like schools. If you're like in a culinary school, a lot of the wine institutions are already reaching out to you, doing those like wine pair, food and wine pairing classes, because they want to kind of cater to the new generation of chefs. You know, you don't know who the next chef is going to be. But in general, I think, yeah, you do a little bit of research. And there's a lot of trade events that are in a regular year that are constantly happening that are open to students. There are definitely resources that you can take advantage of. But that if you're taking a culinary class, for the most part, there's always a wine class in there. So wherever your instructor is, make sure that you're reaching out to him and, you know, asking for event invites, because that's something that I remember working as a PR in PR manager and marketing manager. That's sort of what we would always do, like try to reach those culinary students. So I think there are certainly ways in which you can go about it.
Besides the fact that you love New York, is New York a great place for you to be for what you do as a sommelier and with your business?
100%. Actually, this was actually recently too, but in terms of wine distribution, one of the most diverse places for you to get wines from all over the world is actually New York. I guess it comes with all
like everything else in New York. Everything comes from everywhere.
Yeah, and diversity in terms of cuisines that also cater to the diversity in wine. So you have you can have a Croatian restaurant, and then, you know, that would serve Croatian wines or and whatnot. So New York is for the sommelier, it's a wonderful, wonderful industry. If you wanted to go into wine production, maybe California or you know, Washington State might be more for you. But in terms of sommelier culture, it's definitely New York.
Got you. Well, we have kind of run out of time, but it's been a lot of fun talking with you about this and extremely interesting, not only in terms of your background of how you got there, but your knowledge of the industry. There was one other thing, and it'll run us over a couple of minutes, but I just had to touch base about it because you brought it up earlier in terms of the different cuisines that wine can apply to. But I would imagine you have to know a lot about holidays too, in terms of the various, I mean, there's the obvious ones like Christmas and Thanksgiving and things like that, but yeah, there are different cultural holidays, et cetera, and so forth. Does that affect you a lot in terms of your knowledge base and what you have to know?
Maybe I won't go too deep in, like, I might not know what people in Paraguay are necessarily eating, you know, for the holidays. But one good thing about wine in general, and something I touched up on before, it's very regional. So whenever you're learning about, for example, Northwest Spain and how they produce wines there, while you're taking your classes, they would also touch upon important cuisine that's coming from that region. And that's usually holiday related, right? So they would be like, oh, this is done, they do lechon, or they do this type of cuisine. And then this type of wine is the prominent wine of the region. So for the most part, those two together, because wine and food, they're very interrelated. And that's something I guess we're trying to translate for our own cultures. And I've learned a lot having conversations with people from all over the world and learning about their cuisines. And I think more than knowing exactly what type of food it's in a specific location, I think the most important thing is to know your wine, know the technical aspects of the wine. I know Malbec doesn't have as much tannins as Cabernet Sauvignon. So I know that, for example, if there's somebody in Croatia, there's a holiday in Croatia that's focused on fish, I know that I can't suggest Cabernet Sauvignon because tannins and fish don't go very well. So right. Wow. I would suggest like a white. So it's more about that technical knowledge. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. No. That's a really great point. I lost my train of thought on that, but it was a kind of a closing question. While I'm thinking of it, if it even comes back to me, people want to get in touch with you to find out more about what you do. What's the best way for them to do that?
Speaking in the sense of Instagram, it's always a good spot. Like I will respond to your DM, Vino Concierge, or you can reach out. I have a website, www.vinoconcierge.wine. I couldn't find .com, so I did wine. Definitely reach out to me there if you're interested in learning about the industry or, you know, have any food pairing questions, English and in Spanish. I'm always happy to talk about wine.
Yeah. Well, I've been totally enjoying this conversation with you, but we have run out of time. So I want to thank you very much, Lydia Teffy Richards, for taking time to tell us, because you've been very busy. And I just remember what the final question I was going to ask. So I was just going to ask you, what do you see for the future? As we now will pretty soon have the pandemic in our rearview mirror, moving forward when we're back to, I know the industry did well during the pandemic, but when people can travel, et cetera, and so forth, how do you think that's going to affect you? What do you see going forward for you and for your company?
It's something that, a word that I used to say a lot back in 2020, it feels like forever ago, pivoting. So I'm going to be pivoting all the time. Obviously I found a space for my business in the virtual world, but now, you know, as things are opening up, there's a whole world of possibilities, maybe doing more in-person events and even traveling, because wine is also very, very related to traveling. You know, pretty much any other place that you go to will have some kind of wine region. So I'm thinking, and that's something that actually I'm planning for the future, maybe doing type of wine trips with a colleague. I think there is definitely a field for that. And I think people are going to be more excited about travel. So if I can connect that with wine, that and food and the whole thing, I think it's something that could work really well for me. But for now, you know, definitely sticking to the virtual world until it's possible, and then figuring it out as I go. But that's a good thing about wine. Everybody, and for the most part, people enjoy it. People would travel for it. And you know, it's so interrelated with food. So I can definitely have some fun and be creative, which I've tried to be for most of my career.
Lydia Richards, you have a very bright future. Wishing you the very best.
Thank you so much, Vincent. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for being on Profiles of Color. As you all know, each week I do a deep dive, casual conversation, looking into the lives of inspiring individuals who have compelling, often revealing, and definitely enlightening stories to tell. And I'd like to thank Lydia Richards, the founder of Vino Concierge, for joining me. Profiles of Color is a multimedia production of the Private Air Media Group and is available on most podcast directories, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, TuneIn Radio, Amazon Music, and soon Apple Podcasts. Guest bookings for Profiles of Color are coordinated by Christine Richards. To continue enjoying Profiles of Color podcasts, please subscribe to whichever podcast directory you're currently listening on. Thanks a million for being a loyal listener. Stay safe. Take care and have a good one.